I don't know if you can read my shirt, but it says, "What if Jesus meant the stuff he said?" Now, yeah, this is generally the response I get is people ask, like, well, of course Jesus meant the stuff he said. So on the back, there's the entire Sermon on the Mount, you know, the text we're in today. Matthew 5 through 7, it's all there. It's even in red letters for you, okay? What I find funny about this shirt, though, is that I often get this response from people. They're like, well, yeah, of course Jesus meant the stuff he said. And I'll say, yeah, it's got the Sermon on the Mount on the back. And they will say to me, what's that? And it, like, kills me a little, because it's like, okay, you believe that Jesus meant the stuff he said, but you don't know what he said. And I think that's kind of the point of this shirt. It's that it's not the problem is not that we don't take Jesus seriously. The problem is that we don't know what Jesus said enough to take him actually seriously. And so if I were to, like, leave you with, like, one, take this home and do this, I'm going to give it to you right here at the start of the sermon. If you could take the Sermon on the Mount and memorize it, that would be an incredible thing for your Christian life. Because the Sermon on the Mount is like Jesus' longest sermon. This is basically his kingdom. This is what he wants it to look like. In fact, we're going through the whole Sermon on the Mount with this series. And so if you just memorize the verses we talked about each week, it's like a verse a day. I think you could do it. But this text, we find Jesus on a hill, right? On a mountain. Do you remember Bruce talked about this last week? Jesus has gone up on a mountain and he's giving his new law. And it's kind of like the image of Moses going up on the mountain in the Old Testament to give the Jewish people the old law, right? The only difference is that Moses had to get his law from God. Jesus doesn't have to wait. He is God. And he's giving his new law of what his people are supposed to be like. And the text we're in today, Matthew 13 through 16, is the who of the text. It's the who of Jesus' sermons. He did the blessing last week because he was telling you his kingdom's upside down. This week he's going to tell you, who are you supposed to be? The rest of the sermon will tell you how you are supposed to be that. So to be honest with you, if I really wanted a good sermon, I would read this text, and then I would read the rest of the Sermon on the Mount and sit down. Because Jesus is going to tell you exactly what it means to be salt and light. But I want to pull out a few things for you, so let's get to our text. Matthew chapter 5, verse 13. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. This is who we are to be. We are to be the salt and light of the world. And to be honest with you, I think salt and light are two sides of the same coin. The coin is love, and salt and light is how we're supposed to be that. So, let's start with salt, shall we? What is the purpose of salt in our culture? We use it for a lot of things, right? We use it for flavor. We use it sometimes in soil as like a fertilizing agent. We use it in preservatives. We use it in soaps and scrubs, scientific processes. But what did Jesus mean when he said, "You are the salt of the earth"? The most common use for salt in the ancient world was as a preservative. And this is basically how it works, is you take the salt and you rub it on the meat, right? And by rubbing the salt on the meat, you're creating an unequal amount of salt. Basically, salt is one of these things that likes to spread out and even out wherever it is. So you have a bunch of salt on the outside of your meat. It wants to even out and move salt onto the inside of your meat, okay? But what happens is it forces osmosis. So water, then, the water in the meat, is forced out and replaced with salt. The thing about microbacteria is it needs water to survive. And so by moving water out of the meat, the microbacteria can't grow, and thus your meat lasts longer. Now, this isn't a problem for us because we have refrigerators, right? And freezers, and we don't really have to rub salt on all of our meat. But in the ancient world, that's what they did to preserve it. So what does Jesus mean that you and I are the salt of the earth, the preservative of the earth? I think it means this, that you and I are to preserve goodness in this world. I don't think any of you would disagree that our world has a penchant for going very, very bad, right? I mean, we can look at this on a global scale. You don't have to look very far. We can look at it on a national scale, on a local scale. We can even see it in our own lives, right? In our families, in our houses, in our work. Our culture and everything around it is infected with the issue of sin. I mean, this is pretty much the whole point of the Old Testament. Have you ever read the Old Testament? The whole point is God is good and everything else is not. Right? So God will be good and he gives them like promises. He comes to someone and says, I have this promise. I'm going to do this amazing thing in your life. And then like two chapters later, we find that same person God has promised like doing some sort of sin, right? Like every character in the Old Testament has some sort of sin. And the whole point of it is there's nothing we can do to make it good ourselves. And so we're stuck in this cycle of things just going bad, right? Until Jesus comes. And Jesus goes out into the wilderness and he meets Satan out there and Satan tries to tempt him. And Jesus stands firm and breaks the cycle of sin. And how are we to be salt in a world that's always going bad? I think it means we have to preserve goodness. In fact, Bruce actually mentioned this a week ago. He was talking about what it means to hunger and thirst for righteousness. And he said, on the one hand, it means you and I have to have integrity and personal morality. That's what it means to be salt. That's what it means to be salt. It means that we stand up and we live right in a world that is wrong. It means that people should see God by how we live. They should see God by how we treat other people, by how we work, by our finances, by interactions with authority. Christians should be the ones whose very life and ethic point to the greatness of God. Here's what it means to be salt, that our love for God should show by us living right. A great example of this, I actually think, is our associate minister, Rob Carney. Now, since Rob's not here, I'm going to brag about him. And Rob is one of these guys, like, if you knew the amount of effort that Rob goes through every week to help the people around him, you would be shocked. I think many of us in the room can attest to the great things that Rob has done for us. But what is most amazing about Rob Carney is his personal character, his morality, and his integrity. I've worked with Rob for the last 3 years, and I have not once, I tell you, not once, seen the slightest bit of anger, jealousy, malice, hatred, or gossip. I have never seen Rob greedy or unfaithful or selfish. Nothing. His integrity is incredible. I actually have a funny story to tell you about, kind of proves this point. Rob, some time ago, I can actually tell you this because he's not here. Okay, good. Some time ago, was on a vacation with his family, okay? And it was with Sue and the kids were younger. Okay? And they were at a mall somewhere. And the kids were, you know, I don't know exactly what happened, but the kids were being, well, kids. But it had gone too far, okay? So, like, they'd been, like, I don't know if they were mean to each other, if they were mean to Sue. I don't know what happened, but it had gone too far, and Rob had had enough. So he sits them down on this bench. The kids still remember what bench it is to this day. So he sits them down on this bench, and he starts laying into them, like, guys, you can't act that way. You cannot treat Sue that way. This is not acceptable. And according to the kids, this is the day that Rob cussed. The day. Like, I don't know what word he said. Rob himself has claimed that this is fake news. It never happened. But yeah, so they still, to this day, refer to it as the day Rob cussed. And I think that gets to the point, right, that Rob's character is so upstanding that the people in his life can point to one day and laugh at it. Can the same be said for you? Can the same be said for me? Where one possible slip-up is either shocking or humorous to the people around you because your life is so upstanding that they just can't think otherwise. I don't know if that's true for me. Rob's love for God shows in his passion for living right. And this is what it means to be salt in the world. Jesus will ask his disciples, if salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? And did you know that actually another rabbi at the same time as Jesus was asked this very question by his disciples and he answered it? So this other rabbi, same time as Jesus, his disciples come to him and say, Rabbi, if salt loses saltiness, how do we make it salty again? What's the trick? And the rabbi, you know, in his wisdom, answers the question. He says, and this is a little gross, he says, oh, it's simple. You mix the salt with the afterbirth of a mule. And you and I are like, bleh. But then you think about it, and you're like, wait a second. Mules are infertile. They can't have children, which means there's no such thing as a mule's afterbirth. So what was the rabbi saying? Well, he was saying, it's not possible. It's impossible to make salt salty again. Now, the perceptive among you might say, but it's also impossible for salt not to be salty. I don't know about you, but I've never had salt go bad from sitting in the cabinet, right? Like, it just never goes bad. So what is Jesus actually saying? Like, how does salt lose its saltiness? We have to put ourselves in Jesus' context again. He's not too far from the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee drains down into the Dead Sea, and the Dead Sea is a very salty sea, right? Like, if you go there and you swim in the Dead Sea, you're going to float. And it's very salty, and what happens is on the side of the Dead Sea, there kind of forms this, like, salt-mineral mixture. And it looks like salt, and I'm sure if you tasted it, it would be very salty. And so what would happen is the salt dealers would go down, and they would scoop up this salt-mineral compound. Another problem was it wasn't really salt. It was salt mixed with other things. And they would scoop it up, and they would take it to the market, and they would sell it as pure salt. And so people would come, they would buy this salt, and it wasn't pure. And what would happen is they'd take it home, they'd rub it on their meat, and of course it's not as much salt as they think. And so not as much salt is moving into the meat, not as much water moving out. Okay, microbacteria starts to grow, ruins the meat. And this is what Jesus is saying. Listen, this is what he's saying. Don't let your salt be mixed with other things. My friends, people will try to sell us salt mixed with other things. I can give you an example. You've heard the phrase, God helps those who help themselves. This is a phrase people have passed it off as if it were a biblical passage, like it was in the Bible, Jesus said it. I have a truth for you. It is never said in the Bible. It is not salt. It is sold with salt, but it is not salt. It is not a biblical idea. In fact, about this idea, God says more things like, he sends his rain on the righteous and the unrighteous alike. Or when Paul writes, when we were dead in our trespasses, you can't help yourself if you're dead. In the uncircumcision of our flesh, he made us alive with him, having forgiven all our transgressions. When we were helpless, not able to help ourselves, God helped us. And so we must be very, very careful that we don't buy salt mixed with other things. And there are a lot of things. I can't list them all for you today, but I will list a few that affect Americans more than others. Materialism has been sold with the Christian salt. I mean, Christmas, hello. Individualism, right? It's a very American idea. Partisanism. Even nationalism can be very dangerous for a church. I mean, my heart breaks when I consider the churches in Germany during World War II who stood by and let Hitler reign and said nothing, because they'd been sold a salt that was mixed with other things. So our kingdom is the kingdom of God, not the empire we live in. We are called to be salt. And when any of these things affect our love for God and our love for others, then our salt has lost its saltiness. Let's move to the second image that Jesus gives. You are the light of the world. What does Jesus mean when he says light? That's a good question for us. Let us also put ourselves back in his context. Imagine a group of travelers. They're heading from Jesus' area, Galilee, and they're walking to Jerusalem. You know, Jerusalem was a city on a hill. And so they're walking to Jerusalem, and night starts to fall. Well, their world is very different than ours, right? Like, we have street lamps, like, everywhere. In the ancient world, that was not the case. Despite what our movies show, which is like, I don't know if you've, like watched movies, and then, like, these ancient movies, there's, like, torches lighting the road all the time. I have news for you. They did not have torches lighting the road all the time. Like, that didn't happen. And so it would get really dark. And there were things in the darkness. There were robbers and there were wolves. And imagine you're a walker. You're kind of stumbling around in the darkness. You can see the road below you, but you don't really know what's out there. And in the distance, you see a little light on a hill, Jerusalem. And man, what good news that would be. You know you're getting to your destination. You know you're not that far. You only have a little bit way to go. Church, this is our purpose. To be a light that guides the weary travelers who have been walking in darkness for some time. And our hope is that when they come to the light, they'll find that it's not us that's standing there, but Jesus. If you read the book of John, you'll actually find more of what Jesus meant when he said light. In John chapter 3, Jesus has a really interesting interaction with a guy named Nicodemus. Nicodemus is a Pharisee, and he comes to Jesus at night, which is a really important code word for what's going on in this situation. And so he comes to Jesus at night, and he says to Jesus, Jesus, I know you're a prophet come from God. And so they have this little conversation about what it means to be a part of the kingdom. And Jesus says to Nicodemus, well, Nicodemus, you need to be born again. And Nicodemus is like, so I need to go back to my mother? And Jesus is like, what? No. Like, you need to be born of the Spirit. So he has this conversation with Nicodemus, and he gets to the end, and he has this great verse, right? John 3:16. For God so loved the world. Have you ever read what Jesus says after that? Actually, there's some conversation about whether it's Jesus that said this or John saying this, but either way, it's there. It says, verse 17, for God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe stands condemned already because they have not believed in the name of God's one and only son. It says, this is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but people loved darkness instead of light because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that their deeds will be exposed. Kind of a funny thing to say to a guy who's coming at night. Listen, what it means to be light is that we reveal the deeds that are hidden in darkness. We shine a light on the darkness. And our light should reveal evil. So if salt, on the one hand, is showing our love for God by living right, then light, on the other side, is our love for others showing and standing for what is right. One of my favorite writers and thinkers is a guy named Shane Claiborne. That's actually where I got this shirt, from his community. Shane is a guy who runs a Christian community in Philadelphia. And this is kind of how it started. Shane was in college at the time, and he'd heard that there were 100 homeless families living in an abandoned Catholic church in Philadelphia. Like, there's this area of Philadelphia that's abandoned. It's empty. And there was a Catholic church there housing 100 homeless people. And Shane thought, that's pretty cool. Like, using a church building to care for people who need it. And then he found out that the Catholic diocese and the government in Philadelphia decided that they didn't want these homeless people living in this church. And so they sent the police to give the people a memo like, hey, at this time we're going to arrest you if you don't leave. And so Shane, you know, like, hears about this and his heart breaks because he thinks, like, if the church of God cannot be used to house homeless people and it's not being used for worship, then what is it used for? And so he takes his friends and they go to this church and they stand with the people the day that they're arrested. And Shane gets arrested with all of these people because he wanted to stand with them. After this, Shane is trying to figure out how to help these people. So he goes and he spends some time with Mother Teresa. And he keeps asking Mother Teresa, like, how do you do all these great things? You do all these great things. We want to do great things in the city of Philadelphia. How do you do them? And Mother Teresa said to Shane, we don't do great things. We do small things with great love. Small things with great love. And so Shane returned to the city of Philadelphia, and now what they do is they buy abandoned houses. They buy them for like a dollar. They fix them up, and they help homeless people move into them, and they basically created this community of people who they farm their own food, they work their own stuff. They basically live off of the system. It's incredible. And the way that you and I are a light to the world is like Shane, where we stand for justice. And to be honest with you, our churches are not very good at this thing. Our group of churches are not very good at social justice. In fact, the very phrase social justice might make us a little uneasy at times, right? But it is our job as the light of the world, it is our prerogative as Christians to stand for justice. Like, I don't think anybody in this room would disagree that 600,000 unborn children being killed every year by in our nation is an injustice. And we need to stand against it. But it's not the only injustice out there, you understand. What about the sex trafficking industry? Did you know that this industry, this worldwide industry, makes $100 billion every year? That's double what Apple makes. And that's just the stuff that they can find, you know. And we should be calling out this evil at every chance that we get. We should be partnering with ministries that save boys and girls from this kind of evil. We should be willing to talk with people about this issue. What's interesting is this social justice side of sex trafficking actually connects with the personal moral side. Did you know that the sex trafficking industry is basically built upon the porn industry? They're deeply connected. I have a friend, his name is Tony. We went to college together, and Tony's working on a project. He's been working on it for the last 10 years, and he's just tracing the connection between the porn industry and the sex trafficking industry. He's got a movie, it comes out in September. It's called The Heart of Men. And it's just about how one of these is built off the other. And if we're going to stand against one on one side, we need to keep ourselves from the other on the other side. But there are more things than that. What about racism? You and I should be outraged by the number of black teens, men, and women who are killed and no justice is served. It's a disproportionate amount. There are a lot of statistics to support that. And to be honest with you, it's an offense to God when we just remain silent when justice is not served. And so we need to stand with communities that have been affected by these kind of things. We need to stand by the victims and stop blaming them. We need to stop fighting Christian brothers and sisters who are fighting for the justice. Because God's heart breaks when justice is not served. Even this past month, three black teenagers were killed. And in every single one of them, the initial story was something about them being aggressors. And in every single one of them, the witnesses there were able to show that that was not in fact the case. And these stories should outrage us. We can't pick and choose our injustices. We can't turn a blind eye to things like poverty. We can't turn a blind eye to people losing their health care. We can't ignore that most of our chocolate is produced and picked by slaves. We can't turn a blind eye to hate against people because of their skin, their nationality, even their religion. We can't go on pretending that states like Louisiana and Alabama are not incarcerating black men at an incredibly high rate so that they can use them in the work fields and make money for the prison owners. Slavery is still alive, my friends. And as Christians, we have no right to turn a blind eye. Because the moment we do, we fail to be the light of the world. One of the greatest heresies in the American church is that if it doesn't affect me, it doesn't matter. There's nothing further from the truth. Now, let me say this. Voting is a great tool, right? It's a great tool. But it is not your only tool. In fact, one of the problems with just using voting as your only tool to change the world is that it doesn't actually point to Jesus. Because people don't know who you vote for, and there's no candidate that represents Jesus, right? Like, you're stuck here. You vote for one, and you never tell people who you vote for, and how does that point to Jesus? And so we're going to have to use some other methods. It's pretty easy. We mourn with those who mourn. We stand with the victim and the oppressed. We use our voice, our platform, even our very lives to speak for justice. Can I take a moment to think that the men in Portland who didn't love their lives so much as to stand by and let injustice happen before them? And they died for it. Did you know that Jesus was a protester? This might come as a surprise to you, but he actually did. In fact, this will, in a lot of ways, lead to why he died. Towards the end of his life, Jesus, you know, comes to Jerusalem and he rides the donkey into the city. We all love this scene, the triumphal entry, right? Jesus is king. All right. What does he do after that? Well, he goes in, he kind of looks around, and then he goes out to Bethany, and you're like, well, that's weird. And then he comes back the next day, and he goes to the temple. And what does he do in the temple? Well, he sang some songs and gave some offering. No! Jesus goes into the temple and he finds the money changer's table. Now, here's the scenario. The temple, you know, required sacrifices. And people would come from very far distances away to present their sacrifices at the temple. Okay? Follow? The problem was the sacrifices had to be perfect. There couldn't be any blemish. And the problem was you have these people coming from a long distance. They're walking their lamb, you know, down the road. It trips on a rock and breaks its leg. You can't sacrifice that lamb anymore. So what do? You have a lamb with a broken leg, and you either carry it back home and get a different one, or what do? So the temple created this program that was started as a good idea. They would sell pre-approved lambs that you could sacrifice. You just had to buy them. You buy them when you get there. Bring your money and buy it when you get there. The problem is sin and greed. And there were some priests who realized they could make a good profit off of this, right? And so they would raise the prices on their sacrifices. They would charge exorbitant amounts to switch money because you couldn't use like Roman money to buy your sacrifice. You had to use the temple coins to buy your sacrifice. So then you had to trade your Roman money for temple money, and then they would just change the price to fit whatever they wanted. And Jesus gets there and he sees this injustice happening and he can't abide it. And so he flips over the tables. He creates a whip and he drives the money changers out of the temple. You realize that Jesus is stopping sacrificing. That is a protest. And we need to be salt and light. And my friends, I want to be like Rob. I want to be like Rob, whose life is so full of integrity that those around can't help but be drawn to Jesus. I want to be like Rob, whose love for God is shown in his passion for living right. And I want to be like Shane, who stands against the injustices, whose love for others is shown by standing for what is right. Do you know the purpose of being salt and light? It's not so that we can be noticed. It's not to, like, build up our own awesomeness. The purpose of being salt and light is actually found at the end of our text. Did you catch it? That they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father who is in heaven. The point of being salt and light is that people will see Jesus, not us. Does your life point to God? Are you standing for justice in a way that people can't help but praise the God you serve? Are you living such a life of integrity that people have no answer to your life but to worship God in heaven? Let me end with one more Shane Claiborne story. Some years ago, the mayor of Philadelphia became rather antagonistic to Shane and his friends. I mean, they're basically breaking the system, and so they didn't really like Shane Claiborne and his Christian community. And one of the things that Shane's community used to do is they would go down to the local park and they would feed homeless people in the park. And so the mayor made this law that you couldn't feed homeless people in a city park, okay? And Shane and his friends, like, they're like heartbroken about this. Like, how do we continue to feed these people who, for the most part, might not have another meal if we don't give it to them? So they hatched this idea. They learned that in their city, they could have a church service in a public park. So they had a church service, and they invited their church, and they invited all the homeless people, and they brought them together, and they had a sermon. They sang some songs. And then they had an extended time of communion. But they didn't do bread. No, they prayed about it and thought about it and decided that for the body of Christ, they would use pizza. And for the blood of Christ, they would use soda. And so that day, they had communion with pizza and soda. And they literally used the body of Christ to feed hungry people. The mayor, of course, was not happy. He had them arrested, Shane and his friends. And they go to trial, and they get into the room, and the judge, you know, like, has them all stand, and he looks at Shane, and he says, "Is that true?" And what he was looking at Shane's shirt. Shane had a shirt just like this, except it said, "Jesus was homeless." And the judge says, "Is that true?" And Shane says, "Well, Jesus did say The birds of the air have nests, the foxes have holes, but the Son of Man, talking about himself, has no place to lay his head. Do you know the next time in the Bible that Greek phrase, lay his head, is going to be used? When Jesus bowed his head and died on a cross. The only bed Jesus ever knew was a cross. And so he says to the judge, yeah, it is. And the judge nods, and he says to the group, I see no reason why this trial should continue. And he threw out the trial. You see, because Shane chose to be the salt and the light of the earth, he was able to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ to a courtroom of people. And when we choose to be salt and light in our world, God will be glorified. And when our love is shown by living right, and when our love for others is shown by standing for what is right, God is glorified.